I previous projects were in political data, and I've recently been working more in agriculture and ranch data, which led me to Hyperledger Sawtooth and Hyperledger Fabric. I work a lot with Oregon State University, which is our state's agriculture institution. So I have some, I guess some hands in the ag department there. And the project I've been most recently working on is a project called All the Farms, which is a database that helps people find their local farms. And we're also backing that up on blockchain, just due to the larger industry moves.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining.
Hey, Jim, I apologize. It's Elisa Worley from Accenture. You broke up a little bit. Who did you say you work with?
I have my own company. It's
Oh,
called
fantastic.
Terrapin. It's called Terrapin, Oregon, and some of the different data applications they've been working on.
You know what, Jim, I keep losing your audio when you say it. Could you maybe type it into the chat?
Yes.
Thank you. Because it sounds great. It sounds really interesting.
Thank you, Jim, for joining. So let me get started here and share my screen. And start with our antitrust policy notice that we have to start every meeting with. It's here on our wiki page. Take a moment to take a look at it. And I already posted in the Zoom chat our agenda. The link to the agenda, which you can find here on our wiki. So we just did introductions. If there's anyone else new, please feel free to jump in and just introduce yourself. I do want to get started right away because we have a presentation from Kiva coming up later on. It's going to be really interesting, and I have a few topics that I need to cover before then. Specifically, our survey results. So most of you participated in, we had a survey that went around to our community, I forget when we started, maybe a month ago. We had a really good level of responses, so thank you so much for doing that. And I want to share with you the outcomes of the survey. So a few statistics about our community, just to start off with. I was really impressed with how global it is. We really cover almost all the regions. South America, Asia, Europe, and we are predominantly in the US. That's why I have this box here, because these both were US. And then someone doesn't live anywhere, they just live in the world. I'd love to know who that person was. But yeah, it's a pretty international group, which I think is really amazing. In terms of what the group members do, just to get a sense of what you're involved in, a lot of you are involved in software development and architecture. As well as in project management, program management, and marketing and business development. So communication has been a topic for the group for a while, kind of deciding what's the best communication. It seems that email and the mailing list is what you all prefer. Sorry, the chat got me distracted. I was just seeing if someone was asking a question. So it seems that you all prefer email, which is great. So we'll continue doing communications there. And chat, which I was very surprised because we had heard that people don't know much about chat or don't use it very much. So I was pleasantly surprised to see that it came up as number two. If anyone wants to get on our chat or understand how to get on it or use it more, feel free to reach out to me. Maybe on the next call, I'll just go over it again so that more people can use it. Another thing that was interesting, we asked, you know, what is it that you're interested in learning about at Hyperledger? Which of our tech frameworks and tools? And these are the ones that came up the most, specifically Hyperledger Fabric, Indy, and Sawtooth. So Dan would be a great person for you to chat with about Sawtooth, as he's been heavily involved in that project. But it's a good thing to know that maybe we should be bringing in more speakers from the Hyperledger projects to share more about those frameworks and the other ones as well. So that's really useful to know. And if you guys have any questions or comments while I'm talking, feel free to jump in. Then another question we had was about why you're here in the interest group. So this is the graph, but I have on the next slide the top ones written out because the graph cuts off the words a bit. So the main reasons why you're here is you said explore how to apply this new technology for greater good, build a collective voice in the blockchain and social impact space, business networking, and then two answers that got the same amount of responses was adding value to your own projects and learning. So it seems like the group really wants to learn and explore the technology, build our own perspective and voice, and meet others in the process. Then we went on to what kind of role would you like to play? And so the roles that were most popular were to develop ideas and participate in drafting a white paper, contributing to a work product, and doing research. So that's great because these are things that I think we've been talking about wanting to do in this group for a long time, but we haven't got started on. And so it's really awesome to see that the top three things that everyone wants to work on is really doing something tangible. And then there was a three-way tie for serving as a tech liaison, a SIG liaison, and just being here to chat, which is perfectly fine as well. One thing that came out low, but three people did select this, was leading or managing the SIG work product or project. So even though that's not something that everybody said was a role they wanted to take on, those people that did select that, please keep that in mind as we sort of go through this presentation in the next few weeks, we start really talking about what these work products will be because you could lead or manage it. Then there was an opportunity to kind of write in some of your own answers on what are some of the sort of key questions or issues that this group should consider and answer. So some of it was related to environmental issues, tracking and accountability. Again, getting back to having that voice that shapes what happens with this technology. In the social impact space, defining our objective as well, which hopefully this survey will help with, and I think it really will. building use cases, affordability and accessibility, again, environmental, and then helping with some standards for best practices on projects. Continuing on, identifying what gaps exist, again, best practices, mapping the social impact space, so what is it that's already being done, and what are some areas that should be explored, how to connect with the broader social impact community, and help others use this technology. So I kind of sort of summarized the what I sort of got from this was that we want to be a voice and thought leader to shape the technology, build use cases, shape standards, consider the environmental impacts, and map and understand what's already being done. So then we had a question on areas. So this has been a topic of discussion in this group as well. There's obviously so many different areas in the social impact space and areas that people want to explore using blockchain, as you can see from the variety in this list. There were three ties for the top three. We had digital currencies and aid in development, supply chain and overall sort of environment, like sustainable supply chains or fair trade and sourcing, things like that. Then traditional aid and philanthropy. Then just more generally best practices. And then for the third one, I thought maybe these choices were actually redundant in the end, but governance and accountability and governance and democracy. I think in terms of thinking about what we might want to focus on immediately, we should look at these four, since there were so many ties. Okay, so then we said, once we've got some of these main topic areas selected, which we identified in the last slide, what should be next? What's our next step? So you said defining the use cases, defining the best practices and standards, gathering some proposals based on those topic areas that we chose as we're most interested in, and then drafting some sort of a white paper on one of those topics. So we've got some tangible next steps, which I think is really useful. And so to summarize a bit what all the takeaways I wrote up on the bottom of it, of it, each screen. Before I get into that, Ariana, how does the group plan on leveraging existing resources, materials, and frameworks? There's quite a bit that already exists in these areas. Do you have audio, Ariana?
Yeah, I'm here.
Ah, okay. I think that, I mean, I'm not gonna, that's something that we would obviously, would be part of the research, right? What's already out there? What bringing that all together in one spot, perhaps. I think that that's something that the group would have to incorporate and research once we start along the paths of these goals.
Thank you.
Do you have anything that you want to share?
Do you
feel like you know a lot, you have a lot of those resources that you could share?
Yeah, no, I think a lot of this exists already from other working groups or other initiatives. And so I don't want y'all to recreate the wheel or the group to recreate the wheel in that sense. So I'm happy to, like, I don't know the mechanisms for how the research is planning on being done. But I think before we jump into, like, you know, picking a topic and writing a white paper, et cetera, there's already so much that's been done. There just is really poor communication in the space. So I think it would be best to probably spend far more time actually on the research and like aggregating the information before there is like an original piece created.
Arianna, we actually had started at the outset putting together opportunity matrices to, in order not only to talk about what was, where was the most need, where was the, what was the feasibility, but also capture kind of the landscape. We know that there's a ton that exists in this space, and you're right, connecting the dots can be a challenge. But I think with the community that is joining these calls and beyond, we can probably get at least a pretty decent shape of what's out there and where can we add something new to the conversation. So I think maybe we just need to continue moving forward and completing those living documents, which are those the opportunity matrices.
Yeah, I think, you know, then some of the, one of the topics that was selected, let's say aid and philanthropy. I don't think the group is going to just go and start writing about blockchain and aid and philanthropy. There would be research on existing projects that would be part of that effort. Just like any good sort of literature review. And if you have, I think, Arianna, if you are really connected to some of those resources, it'd be great for you to be involved in that research effort and helping maybe bring it together since it is pretty disparate. So to summarize some of the takeaways, you said you wanted to learn more about different Hyperledger technologies. You said that you're here because you want to learn and explore, build a perspective on blockchain and social impact, and meet others in the process. You said that you wanted to contribute by drafting a white paper, doing research in this space, including mapping use cases and best practices, and connecting with others in the Hyperledger community. You said it was important to you that we be a thought leader to shape the technology, shape standards, consider environmental impacts, and understand what is being done already. So I think that that's your question, Arianna. And that you want to do the above, be it explore use cases, shape standards, understand what's already being done, etc., in the topics of digital currencies, aid philanthropy, supply chain, and best practices in implementation. And in terms of what we should tackle first, you said that we should define those use cases and best practices and identify some proposals in the interested areas. And start drafting some sort of an output on that. Any other sort of comments or questions? Oops, that's not what I meant to do. Trying to do that. No one else is commenting. So, in terms of
that's too optimistic. That's what I was telling Anita. But the right numbers will show up. When
someone go ahead. Please, if it's Pradeep.
Yeah, when you're speaking about this, right? So, this is 45. DBs running,
Bobby,
and we have a total of 420.
Okay. So then finally, the only reason we have this information is because you all participated in the survey. So it's really useful to have this information to now kind of move forward in what we want to do with the special interest group. I invite you all to, I'll share this on our agenda, so I invite you all to read over it and think about the results. Think about what you would like to do specifically and get involved in. And in our next call, we'll talk about what the next steps are, maybe establish some of the teams and subgroups or leads for these activities that we identified we're interested in working on. Any other questions or comments?
Sorry, I was stuck on mute. No, this is great, Karen. It's really insightful.
Yeah, I also think this is cool also to feed into the DCI work group, the experience that you had putting the survey together as we start thinking about doing one over there too.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so I'm going to keep moving on because I want to leave Matthew plenty of time for his presentation. So the next thing on our agenda is laying out the SIG chair election process. So I mentioned on our last call that we'll be having a chair election. And so if you're interested in the SIG chair, you can, by this Friday, please send to me your name, email, title, company, and LinkedIn page, and 200 words on why you would like to be chair, what's your commitment and vision. I think having the survey results is really going to be useful for the chairs to express their interest, because then now you can draw on what the community has said they want to do. And what I'll do is I'll gather all these expressions of interest and create a page on our wiki to post them all and give you all a time to review everybody's expression of interest and then share with you a tool and deadline by which we'll need your votes. So if you're interested in that, please start putting that together and send it to me by Friday. If you have any questions about what a chair does or what it involves, feel free to reach out to me. I did post the chair responsibilities in our meeting notes from last time, so you can take a look at that. And I'm happy to help answer any questions or support you in any way. It's a really exciting role to have and a great way to demonstrate some leadership in the Hyperledger community as well. So with that, I will hand it over to Matthew.
Hi, I am here. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Perfect. If you can dump your screen share, then I can hijack and throw up my slides. There we go. Okay. Now, does everybody see full screen, a big old green slide?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Hi, my name is Matthew Davey. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer at Kiva. I'll make the vast assumption that you have at least a vague idea of what Kiva does, but I'll go through that. And I kind of wanted just to spend maybe 10 or 12 minutes today kind of driving everybody here through Kiva's foray into DLT and blockchain space, how we got here, why we're here. So I'll give you a quick primer on Kiva, literally one slide, just as a refresher of what we've done for the past 13 years. And then I'll go into how and really the why we're using DLT and how we came to the decision of doing it in Hyperledger. And then these days, I can't get out of a conversation without at least acknowledging Kiva's participation in Libra. So I'll give you a little bit about Libra and why we're involved in Libra and what we see as the future for Libra. And I'll leave plenty of time. Again, I'll keep this presentation pretty short. I looked at the names of who's here, and about half of you I know I've talked to about this at some point, so I won't labor any of this. But to start with the why, Kiva exists, and these are my words, not Kiva's. Kiva exists because the world's not fair. And a lot of people are born into poverty. And so not only are they born into a harder life, the system actually does not provide them a pathway to get out of poverty. So even if they work twice as hard as someone born further up the economic inclusion ladder, they won't make twice the progress. They won't even make the same amount of progress. They'll actually make less progress at bettering their life and the life for their children and for their communities and their families. And it doesn't have to be that way. And so Kiva was started back in 2005 by a bunch of folks who had kind of ejected from PayPal after it got bought by eBay. And they, some of them had traveled the world and said, huh, PayPal did this really fundamental thing of helping peer-to-peer money transfer in the US and all this thing it did for kind of economic expansion. You know, it was primarily targeted at students up front, and then it grew much bigger than that. And really part of the inspiration for Kiva was, what would it look like if we could do something like that, that bridged the gap between where the money is and where the money is not? And so one of our founders was traveling around India and bumped into a lot of microfinance institutions and said, huh, I bet there's a lot of people in the United States who, if they understood the impact of these types of microfinance institutions going out and providing unsecured consumer credit to people who have no access to anything else. And when I talk about no access, I mean, microfinance institutions take wads of cash on a scooter 100 miles out of a city into a rural village, and with a paper ledger, transact with people they grew up with and provide them with the money they need actually to leverage to run a small business or to buy more supplies or to finance something else they're working on for a small enterprise. And so over the past 13 years, since starting in 2005, this number is actually wrong. Kiva's operated in 94 countries. Last year, we operated in 89 of those 94. You could imagine there's sanctions in certain countries that we may have operated in a decade ago, with over 500 active microfinance partners and 2.5 million borrowers last year. We've lent $1.3 billion, US dollars. So this is crowdfunded capital. You can go to kiva.org and you can give 0% money that we will funnel through MFIs and push the MFIs to go reach customers they haven't reached before. And the really interesting thing, the thing that really drew me to Kiva, I joined about a year and a half ago or almost 2 years ago, was the 97% repayment rate. And I was one of the people that fell into the bucket of assuming that default rates would be very, very high in the unbanked world because it would just be hard to collect payments. Like whether or not people were good borrowers, it would actually be hard to collect repayments because you're driving out there on a scooter and dealing with cash and a paper ledger. In Kiva, it's actually 96.9%, but I like the round number. Looking at $1.3 billion and a 97% repayment rate, to me, a light bulb goes off of something is broken here. The fact that more capital is not pouring into this market, because on the ground, credit is marked up to 60 to 100% APR rates. So why is this? The reason that the rates are 60 to 100%, but the default rate is 3%, it's not because these people are hard to reach. That might cost 10% of the loan. So okay, now the loan costs 13%. It's still priced at 60 to 100%. The real reason is the system was never set up to include unbanked people, and they are unbanked by design, by accidental design, but by design. And so what would it take to have systemic financial inclusion? These are the five steps, and really the fifth one is the most important, flow of funds. The money exists in the world to provide substantial financial inclusion to every adult on the planet. The problem is it doesn't exist in the world that they live in. How do you get it there? Well, the first two, and I'll give the entire financial sector a hall pass for everything up until the late, like before 2010, that until we had smartphones and really as we're moving towards satellite internet, the internet service and device access to connect to a bank, that was laying copper wire and putting a brick and mortar building. And that just was not, forget about economics, it wasn't logistically feasible to think you could run a copper wire 100 miles out to a village and have it be reliable. But that's not the case anymore. Between now and 2030, we're gonna have global internet coverage and pretty much global device access, whether it's a shared, you know, $20 Android device or whether it is your own smartphone in your pocket. If you have those, now you can be connected to the sector. The next two things that are necessary is that the money that exists in the formal financial sector is gated behind two things. It's gated behind verifiable trusted identity. And that KYC AML check exists for a reason. And it's the reason that we can all put money into a savings account and know that it's not going to be used to fund terrorist activities. And it's not going to be going somewhere we didn't want it to go. And that if I transact with someone with my credit card, that there's a system to catch fraud and just to make sure there's trust in the financial sector. And so it's important that that trust maintains in the financial sector. And that is a blocker for it moving down if unbanked customers don't have trusted verifiable identity. Once they have that, I even tried this just for kicks. I called up the banker at Bank of America where I have my savings account and said, hey, I'd like to loan out my rainy day savings fund through Kiva. And he said, can't do it. As a fiduciary, I cannot do that. Bank of America will not let me take your money and allocate it through something like Kiva because I need to be able to run a credit report to be able to understand the risk, to adequately price the risk before I can hawk you any services. And so that's the second gate. But if these first four were done, and again, I think the first two, that's game over by 2030. That is happening, and we don't all need to push on that. That's happening already. But if we can get trusted, verifiable identity that's compatible with the financial sector and complete credit history into the unbanked world, we would be in a position where banks wouldn't even need me to call up and say, could you loan my money to unbanked previously unbanked customers? The banks themselves would say, 3% default rate, 60% cost of capital. I'll price it at 40% and make a ton of yield here. This is a great investment. And the question really becomes for the Deutsche Banks and the HSBCs of the world, how much money can I move? Not can I move money? And so how do we come to DLT? We looked at it and said, these first two are a solved problem over the next 10 years. We've been doing this in our own little silo. We've been doing identity for all of our borrowers and all of our lenders and building our own siloed credit histories for 13 years. What if we found a way to extend that out to a system without having to have us be the linchpin in the middle of it? And that's where DLT came in. I use the term trust in a trustless environment a lot, but the ability to say, here is a system that allows you to trust data, trust the integrity of the data, and be able to verify the provenance of the data. DLT does exactly that. And so again, the challenge it's solving right now, here's what a developing country looks like. There's all this data. There's microfinance institutions building identity and credit data, and there's mobile money providers and national banks, and then international banks may or may not play in the country at all. None of that data is compatible. And if you could federate it behind the individual, you would end up having totally compatible data. Again, each of these different financial service providers could still be managing their own work streams. But DLT, and specifically decentralized identifiers, allow you to have a system where, since the user is the constant across all of these data streams, having the user own a DID wallet and have DID connections with each of these people would allow the user to map that data together. And what that would solve for is, suddenly everything that I do with an MFI provides me a credit history that I can then take and port with me up the food chain, whether that's to a mobile money provider to get more credit there, or to a community or a regional or a national bank. And so in a nutshell, this is my one sentence on Kiva protocol. What's really important about it, it's a very, very low cost. We're talking, you can do identity verification and credit checking for pennies instead of dollars, that enables systemic financial inclusion. We want to change the system so that by design, all people, their data can be federated behind their own private self-sovereign identity and used to build a financial inclusion machine. What does this look like? So we're currently in the middle of implementing this in Sierra Leone, which is a case study I can talk about later. But this is not about saying all of you must use a Kiva cryptocurrency and a Kiva this and a Kiva that. This is literally just about using DLT and using decentralized identifiers to connect the data. So all these banks already have management information systems, like the one you're looking at here. What Kiva protocol can do on the identity side is allow them to run a real-time KYC check using the customer's DID wallet. So the customer can walk in with their thumbprint and their national ID number, can thumb in, put in their national ID number. That can make a KYC call back to the issuer. It's using the verifiable credentials model, and come back and say, wow, this person, like, on the spot passed a KYC check. And it can pre-populate their loan application form, and it can sanitize the data to make sure gender doesn't get in there and to make sure other markers that shouldn't be in a loan application form don't get in there. And so literally, when the bank would say before, like, I can't verify who you are and I don't understand your credit history, in Sierra Leone, as we're integrating this, this will become as simple as a thumbprint and a national identifier to be able to go in and prove your identity. And then if you so choose, to share information locked behind that identity. I'm going to skip this slide. I'll send the slides out. You can read this. But basically, verifiable credentials as a data model has the potential to solve the cumbersome process of KYC, because there's no more trying to find a bunch of different claims that are physical and then upload them and then have someone say, I trust these, and now I trust that you're Matthew. You can literally say, well, you're telling me the government says you're Matthew. I'm going to call the registry and see if that claim is valid. Up, claim is valid. You just passed a KYC check, because literally I asked the issuer of civil identity in the country to verify that you're you. And they gave it back to me and they said, yes, that's correct. Like, the photo and all the other stuff you sent me about Matthew in that claim, I am validating that he just passed a KYC check. And in a place like Sierra Leone, which you might imagine is not the best internet connection in the world, that round trip to a bank to go back to the registry in Freetown and then back to the bank takes less than 2 seconds to do that entire verification. So we, you know, instead of about 2 weeks for a KYC check, you're talking about a couple of seconds. And so here's where we want to land. Our theory of change is that if we can finish number three and number four, if Kiva can be part of the solution and decentralization and decentralized ledger technology can be part of that solution, we'll be in a position where all that's necessary now is flow of funds. And I will personally assert, having had many discussions with big banks, that with the yield profile that's available to unbanked customers, once this starts to churn at scale, money will flow into the unbanked sector. And we will no longer be relying on humanitarian aid or on NGOs and nonprofits. We will actually have the formal financial sector wanting to and able to include the last human on the planet. And I think that is an awesome inclusive future. And so if you look at where we're at now, you know, we're starting in Sierra Leone, which is around the almost the westernmost tip of West Africa. You know, we're now looking at other countries around the world to do the same thing at a national scale, work with the government to extend all these consumer first and inclusive technologies for financial inclusion. And this is why we're doing it. I think unlike a lot of other talks I run into in the space, the technology is definitely the tail and the impact is the dog for us. And so we are very much interested in enabling individuals. And it so happens that DLT is the best way to do that for a variety of reasons. Okay, and I know I'm zooming through this. Libra, I have to say it since I'm in the room. Here's the couple things I'll say about Libra and what we find interesting at Libra. And I'll speak as a little bit as Matthew and a little bit as Kiva. So as Kiva, we work a lot at the intersection of formal and informal financial services. And a lot of what we're trying to do globally is make it so that formal money that's locked out of the informal economy can move into the informal sector, because we need that to happen. Again, that's step five of money must flow. We need that to happen. And so if you look at what we're doing with Kiva Protocol, we're talking a lot about data interoperability so that the ability to serve customers that might make $2 a day, it's just as easy and as attractive as serving a customer who might make $2,000 a day. And so we work a lot at the intersection between government regulators and formal banks and then totally informal sector. And while we're not doing a currency, if you play out what we're doing with Kiva Protocol, one of the next three or four things you would want to do once you have verifiable identity and once you have like a robust credit history for an individual, you'd want to solve the problem of it's really hard to get on a scooter and drive cash back and forth to villages. And this is not going to be an overnight thing, but this is where cryptocurrency starts to get interesting for Kiva. And when we talk about Kiva Protocol, a lot of people think, oh, you're going to like raise your loans in Bitcoin and distribute them in Bitcoin. And that's not the case. These users are using cash. But as the ecosystem develops, we do see a lot of peer-to-peer transactions on the ground probably growing, and the ability for individuals, as they're doing stuff like Kiva.org and crowdfunding loans on a marketplace, wanting to be able to do direct remittances back and forth. And why we're drawn to Libra, or why we decided to sign up with Libra as a founding member, is really twofold. One is Libra is sitting right at that intersection intentionally of regulated and non-regulated. So they're playing ball with regulators saying, you're right, you should be looking at these things, and that this is about a KYC check, not just about total privacy. It's about privacy by design, but getting in and out of fiat should require a KYC AML check, and we want to make sure consumer protections are in place. We think that's really interesting, and that's aligned with ours of we have to interface with the existing system and help move the existing system forward, not go way off into left field and try to build a new system and hope that it sticks. That there's enough good things coming out of the existing system with consumer protection and a bunch of other vectors. And Libra sits right there. The second one is, look, it's for all the things that people I think will paint Libra bad with, and they should be acknowledged. Like if you take something that a lot of people don't like Facebook, and combine it with something that a lot of people don't understand, like cryptocurrency, you're gonna get a lot of noise and a lot of questions. And that's, I mean, Libra is Facebook plus cryptocurrency. We believe it's actually really worthwhile to work with this consortium and to work with Facebook if, for no other reason, Facebook has 2.3 billion monthly active users across its properties. So if you want to see a systems change in terms of payments, and for everything that this will get painted as like, oh, it's a bunch of power players looking to like entrench their power, if you take away the current power players, you have no scale when you're going out the door. And so speaking for myself and speaking for Kiva, we think it will be necessary to optimize the flow of funds and remittances into the unbanked world. And we think it'll happen over a number of years. And having a seat at the table with an organization as big as Libra could be to advocate for vulnerable populations, like we'll do that every day of the week and twice on Saturdays, to have a seat at the table to make sure that this doesn't just help my coffee in San Francisco get $1 more expensive, that this actually helps someone who makes $2 a day have a path to making $4 a day and $8 a day and eventually escaping poverty. And so there we go. I think that's all I got. That's what I got. I wanted to just kind of blast through that and leave maximum time for people to ask me questions. So please do feel free.
Hey, that was super cool. Couple questions. One is, could you talk a little bit more about the flow with the fingerprint? Is that matching up against a national database, how that works? And then maybe more importantly, the second or third question is, what's the shared data use case that implies a DLT instead of just individually querying separate bank databases? Any interesting privacy requirements that you came across and whether or not you feel those can be satisfied using today's technologies?
That's all great questions. Writing a note here so I don't forget all of them. So look, fingerprint ID is not identity, it's authentication. And so when Sierra Leone, I should give a little context. The reason we're implementing in Sierra Leone first is that there was a lot of work done by the government and by UNCDF and UNDP, the UN Capital Development Fund and the United Nations Development Program, over the past 4 years to get the financial sector ready for innovation and also to establish civil ID at a national scale. So basically every adult in Sierra Leone was registered over 2017 and 2018 for a national civil ID. And so that registered biometrics, face scan and fingerprints, and it also got 40 data fields about the individuals to then be able to issue national ID. So why thumbprints? Because the system already had fingerprints in place and had already issued national ID, the combination authentication can be really anything that people want authentication to be. It was a very convenient one that we could drop a $40, Amazon NEC thumbprint scanner at all the bank branches. And if the individual walks in with their national ID card and their thumbprint, it's really quick to reduce the search space when you make that call and be able to verify who that individual is, like to find their wallet from an authentication perspective and then use that to verify the claims. So why fingerprint? Because fingerprint was already at a national scale in Sierra Leone. And I think for any authentication mechanism, you can find challenges and there will be those. And fingerprint will not be the only authentication mechanism in Sierra Leone longer term, nor is it a requirement for this type of system. But when users are holding their wallet somewhere in the cloud, or somewhere where it's an agency with someone, you need an authentication service because they don't have an NFC chip on their own phone to auth with. So that's on fingerprints. The use case for sharing data, you could easily go and establish connections with all the, you can go and establish connections with all the banks, and that's how formal credit bureaus work. The problem is twofold. If you're in an environment where internet connectivity is unreliable, or if you want to be able to do this in the offline world, like port the data offline and be able to have some form of identity and credit verification offline, anything that requires a callback to a central server breaks. And so what's great about using decentralized identifiers and using blockchain for this, we're using ND for the identity piece, which does not store the identity data on blockchain. And then we're using Fabric for the credit piece, which is a blockchain, or it is a distributed ledger. What's really important is that in an offline world, if the MFI agent comes offline and has a tablet or has a $40 Android phone, it's possible for them to transact offline using cryptographic tools available offline, get all the claims done offline. Now, it wouldn't have been a real-time KYC check because it couldn't have called back, but it would have a cryptographically signed claim that this is Matt and it has a photo that's been cryptographically signed so I can verify this data is valid offline. And all the transactions can happen offline. They can all be encrypted. And then that MFI agent, when they're riding on their scooter back, when they get connectivity, all of that encrypted data, which can't be changed without it being evident that's changed, can be broadcast back to the network. And so without DLT, you're really dependent on a stable connection to be at the last mile. With DLT, you don't need that. To your third point on privacy, I actually think that decentralization is going to be, this is personal, not Kiva perspective, Matt's perspective. I think decentralization is going to be forced a lot of places over the next decade, just because centralization can't give the type of privacy we need. That centralizing data is a hacking target, compute power is getting cheaper, and it's going to, the way to not get hacked is to make it not worthwhile to hack you. And so the line I use about Equifax, which you all know, because we're talking about DLT here with Hyperledger, don't have one database with a million records. You want to get a million people's records, you got to hack a million times. And I think that's one of the bigger things for consumer privacy. There's a whole bunch of other stuff where if all of my data is gated behind me, then it's not possible for a third party to share it accidentally. Like, they literally have to have me decrypt it for them. And this is why we find it important to have self-sovereign by design, where it's an opt-in if they want to assign agency for someone to hold their identity and guardianship for them. But that gives the most privacy by design. And what we found in Sierra Leone is that these systems are very, very compatible with the government's desires for consumer protection and privacy. That when you start off talking about decentralization, there's a lot of questions about it. But then when you walk through what they're trying to achieve with their updates to digital privacy and consumer protection, that actually they're like, oh, this answers a lot of these questions just by design. Like, we don't even need extra policies around this. Like, you can't do this with that technology. And I'll stop there.
Yeah, thanks for even remembering all those questions at once. Just to dig in a little bit further. So when I think about the conventional architecture for a DLT, we're replicating data across the entire network, and then each one of those nodes has to make an independent decision about whether that's whether there's correct changes to that data. But ultimately, it's there's data replication. So what part of this data is the data that's replicated and shared across all the participants in the DLT network?
Yeah, all it is each individual has an identifier that will be issued back into Fabric. And then behind that is just an encrypted hash. Like all you need is a root hash to show that everything, there will be a distributed ledger for each individual that has each one of their loans out and repayments in the informal sector and the formal sector. And there will be a root hash of that that's attested to onto a main chain. And this is all in a permission network. So none of the data actually has to be on the chain, and we're not planning to put it on chain. This is all like we're still doing the implementation in Sierra Leone. But all you really need is something to provide tamper evidence so that when the user says, this is my full credit history later on, it's very easy to verify whether or not this person is telling the truth. Does that make sense? So it'll just be a hash of each of the loan out, loan in, like each of the credit claims for their history. And this dovetails really nicely into that chat question we got about integrating with banks. And so I would love to pivot to that if that's all right.
Sure.
Perfect. So this only works, again, if you get the entire system reporting. And this is part of why Kiva works with government agencies as an enabler to bring this super cheap. We actually thought there would be more challenges in Sierra Leone with, like, we'd be going out to banks saying, hey, you're now like, or MFIs, like, you're now credit reporting and you weren't credit reporting before. And really what it comes down to is, before, they were required to credit report, they just couldn't. It was too expensive and the systems didn't work for them, and they were sending clear text emails that had data in them that were manually keyed into an Excel 97 workbook. And so we actually expected friction when we're coming saying, you're now gonna have to report through this centralized thing that decentralizes all the data, and there's gonna be credit reporting in the MFI sector. And so far, zero pushback. One, they're going to be compelled to use it because the current credit reporting acts in Sierra Leone and in all countries do require all financial transactions from an institution to be logged to a credit bureau. So one is they already are compelled to. But the second one, they really did understand right away the fact that they're mispricing the risk and they would love to be able to better serve their customers. So whereas some might look at MFIs and say they're greedy, if you talk to the actual people who are on the ground, they're like, look, I don't understand the risk. Like, I don't know if Matt just took out two other loans right before he came to me. So I have to assume he did and assume he's a high default risk and price his money up really high. Even if he's always repaid me on time, this might be the time he's going to get me. They are very hungry for this type of solution to say, God, if you could help me so it's easier to identify who I'm transacting with and be more compliant and understand their entire credit history, I would love to price their risk more appropriately. And they're also looking at it saying, I would be able to access cheaper capital in for my MFI operations if I could be compliant. Because again, they have the same challenge that Kiva might have of, they can't go to Treasury and pull out of Treasury in any of these countries, and they can't get money out of HSBC or Deutsche Bank. But in this scenario where this data exists, they do see the future of, this could really help them have more robust products and services.
Matt, we have a question here in the chat. So Pradeep asked, what are some of the challenges that were faced while onboarding a bank?
Yeah. In Sierra Leone, when we go to these countries where we're working on financial sector deepening and there's not a robust financial sector, there is a lot of on-the-ground systems integration work that has to happen. So we have boots on the ground in Sierra Leone helping the banks do the integrations. Look, the primary challenge so far has been, this is our first time doing this with a third party. We've done this inside of Kiva and integrated this with our systems to make sure this is working, but we have not integrated with a third party bank, and especially a third party MFI where people get on scooters and drive out 100 miles into a village. So the primary challenge, I would say, has really just been, we're bringing new technology and we're integrated into existing, sometimes more stale or older technology. And so there's a lot of, not a lot, there's a couple of days of custom integration work per bank to make it so that their management information system can integrate with something like Kiva Protocol. But that's honestly been the hardest part, and it's getting easier every time because we're building API libraries and things to make it very easy to automate the process for those who want to have a relatively automated system to do it. But for those who think it's too hard, I would say, for as much harder as it is to go to where there's less technology, there is no competition in these places. Like, this has been overlooked by the financial sector because it was hard to do. So if you could stomach the hard, the opportunity is very good to build a robust ecosystem once you get things implemented.
And another question as well is Dan asking if the code is open source or available online.
It will be. It is not yet, but it will be. We're just not, like, if you looked at the modifications we made and how we're building the API integrations, it's not cleaned up enough yet to be open source, but it will be. And to be very clear, our indie implementation looks very much like a vanilla indie network. There's very little custom code on the network side. Same with Fabric. Most of the customization is all the stuff we're doing to make this easy to digest at a national scale. So, you know, doing stuff with Aries to make sure it's interoperable, doing stuff to set it up so it can hook up with a national identity issuer, like all of those things. But it will be open sourced. I'm hopeful that we'll get it open source sometime in Q4 this year. It's just a matter of, like, we're still doing the first in the wild integration, and we really want to settle some of the things out before we have others start picking it up and doing anything with it. But it will be soon, and a lot of stuff will get contributed back into Indy and other places as well.
That'd be awesome. Another question. So how do you ensure that the borrowers are repaying the amount that they're lending?
Yeah, I mean, so there's already systems on the ground with, there's already cash going out and in, and it's recorded in a paper ledger. And so this is just digitizing and building trust in a digital process instead of that paper ledger. The system already works. And we're not trying to change. We're not saying, and change it to digital and change it to cryptocurrency. We're saying, if we could just capture this data, if the identity I was using in the unbanked world could be used by a bank, that would help me get in the door at a bank. And if all of my activity now in the unbanked world and all of my good repayment history actually could help me open a checking account or a savings account or get a home loan at a bank, wouldn't that be great? And so we're not looking at trying to substantively change the actual on-the-ground process. This is MFI agent has a physical ledger, and now we're going to give them a digital ledger to use. And so far, there's been no friction to that at all.
Quick question. Does the current paper system that Kiva uses require a nationally issued ID?
No.
Okay, so how do you plan on bridging the gap? Because, like, the connection between the unbanked and a lack of national ID is pretty, you know, there's a strong correlation there. And so how, because I know that that's been a big critique of Libra, right, where they're saying we want to bank the unbanked, but a lot of the people won't be able to actually access due to lack of the access to, like, a proper KYC. So how do you guys plan on addressing that?
Yeah, and well, and this is where DLT and decentralized identifiers get interesting, because I could start today. I don't have to wait for national ID to get to me. Let's say I live in a rural village in Uganda. If this Kiva protocol type system, if decentralized identifiers were used, I could be transacting with a totally unique DID with my MFI right now. And later on, if I got a separate DID connection with a KYC issuer, I could cryptographically prove through the DID architecture that the person who had a non-KYC identity over there is the same person who has the KYC identity over here. I'd be able to do that, me as the end user. And what that means then is all of my credit history that happened when I was using that informal identity is now going to be able to be used. It is compliant to use for a bank in these countries. And this is the fundamental breakpoint. Right now, people in the unbanked world take out money for 10 years at 60% and have perfect repayment history. And they go to a bank and the bank says, I'm sorry, you have no credit history. I can't give you a home loan. They are blocked out of the system. They get no credit for time served. This is why decentralization, like this is the exact reason why we're using it, is all the activity that happens informally, when the inclusion gets there, when the KYC identity gets to that person, all of their existing data becomes formalized. So suddenly the bank, instead of saying, I can't trust this, they'll take in all the data and say, cool, I now trust the provenance of all of this data. Now I'm just going to selectively choose whose data I want to use. Like I'm not going to use your credit with your cousin, the shopkeeper, but I am going to use your credit with BRAC or with another MFI.
I know we're a little over time. Any last quick question?
Well, just to congratulate for what you're doing. It's really amazing. Congratulations.
Well, it would not be possible without having open source tech like what's coming out of Linux Foundation with Hyperledger, and without especially the communities around the Indie project and the Fabric project. So Kiva does not have a long and storied history in decentralization, so we have been able to stand on the shoulders of giants here. So I want to pay about 98% of that credit back to those who have been championing this for a lot longer than us.
I hope you go as far as Newton did when he said the same phrase.
I think we'll have to if we want to solve the problem. So I appreciate all you guys taking the time. And anybody who wants to learn more, like we're trying, as we've staffed up now, to be more engaged in Indie and Aries and Fabric. So you'll see us around in Hyperledger a lot more. And especially hopefully in Q4 when we open source and like put up a website with all the documentation and marketing collateral around this stuff.
We look forward to your participation, Matt. And thank you so much for taking the time to share this with the Social Impact SIG. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. And for everyone else, please, if you're into any chair election, please send to me your expressions of interest. If not, I'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Good. Bye-bye, everyone.
Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. Thanks, all.